Your meditation has calmed the rains for a time, so I appreciate it. Thank you all. But the weather has definitely changed, and I think that's the microcosmic equivalent of a change in the weather in the macrocosm as well. As the world lurches rapidly into its final storm, perfect storm, in fact, of every kind of cataclysmic event. So we must be spiritually prepared for this transition at the end of the cycle of time to have so completely shed all traces of identification with the vibrational frequencies of Kali Yuga and all of the manifestations of ego that come along with that, so that we achieve the absolute naked awareness that enables us to bring about a rebirth through our consciousness of the purity and the pristine beauty of God consciousness, once all of the obscuring tendencies of ego consciousness and even soul consciousness have been purified, eliminated, then in that total transparency of pure consciousness, the radiant power of God shines through and creates a new dream of unimaginable beauty and of goodness and of joy and of delight for all in the most miraculous kind of world that one cannot really even imagine in one's highest flights of fantasy. Only the touching into self-realization will give a sense of what is ahead for those who have prepared themselves properly to be either reborn in that state or those who participate in the dreaming of that state from the absolute that is forever beyond all appearance. So tonight I decided that it would be important to, for several reasons, to hold this gathering. One, because I know some of our visitors are leaving very soon, and I want to give them a chance to ask any last questions. And secondly, to address the agenda of our study curriculum in going into the next phase that will give us the necessary understanding to be able to navigate through the kind of vibrational fields that will be arising in this plane of the dream field. So to begin with, if you remember, long ago now, we were reading Nobody, Son of Nobody, and we never ultimately came to its analysis at the end. And now it seems a bit stale to do that. However, I think that that tradition is something I want us to keep studying because it's a good counterpoint to the other tradition we're studying of Mahayana Buddhism. So I would like us to get the book entitled Sweet Sorrows. And these are the Sufi enlightenment poems of the great Sheikh Farid Eddin Attar Neshaburi, mostly known as Attar, Sheikh Attar. And these are, again, very short poems, very much to the point, very pungent, and I think very helpful to those who are still in duality but understand that non-duality is where it's at, and there is a usefulness to the appreciation of the path of devotion and of recognition of the self as one's beloved, because it's love that brings union, and through the love of God, which is ultimately the self, that realization of non-duality is attained. It's one way that it's attained. Another way it's attained is the jnana path, the path of sheer intellectual grokking of the truth, but very few can make it on that path because it is so paradoxical, so subtle, so difficult for the mind that is locked into duality and conceptualization to grasp, because it is never something that can be the direct object of thought. However, you can use thought to be able to recognize that although it cannot be reached, you are already that. And so the path that the second path that we are on already is the path of the study of Mahayana Buddhist sutras. And we are now doing the Lightning Strike Sutra, known also as the Diamond Sutra or Diamond Cutting Sutra. And we will continue with that. In fact, tonight I'd like to go further to the next section. But I'm intending to continue, once that's done, to some of the other major Mahayana sutras. Some of them are so amazing. They are literally psychedelic trips, and the beings who wrote this were not only Buddhas, but they were Buddhas on DMT, you know, and so the study of those sutras is something that will take you immediately to that level of consciousness that is being so incredibly described. That was written back, you know, in those ancient days, thousands of years ago, although some of them were written later into the hundreds, up to about 800 AD, I suppose. But most of them are much older. And some of the ones that seem younger were orally transmitted before being written down. So there's a tremendous corpus of extraordinary poetic writing that expresses the mind of an enlightened being from the phenomenological perspective of being that one going through the various dimensions of and dream fields that open up to one who is not limited to a particular world or identity, but whose consciousness has been completely freed of all limitations. So I think it's something worth our study of as we enter into a time when all of those limitations are actually being eliminated from the phenomenal plane altogether, because everything that everyone took for granted, felt supported by, used as attachments and props and objects of security and of a sense of identity, are all being washed away in the flood. And so if we have reached that level of consciousness that cannot be washed away, that cannot be lost, that cannot be harmed, that cannot be burned in the fires, that cannot die, are we able to sustain the continuity of consciousness into the next cycle? So, to continue with the Diamond Cutting Sutra then, we're on section 9, and I decided for this one I would read from a different translation that I think in this particular section that this translator, a Chinese, well actually it's Tom Graham who has translated a Chinese master's commentary, but a Chinese version of the sutra, Master Sing Yun. But the book is titled Describing the Indescribable. And I think it's a useful alternative translation because, you know, changing one word can affect the sense of what is actually being implied in a sutra. Translation is a very high art, and if you don't get the exact right tone or make the right decision, are you going to use, let's say, a word like dharma? Are you going to translate it, or are you going to leave it in Sanskrit, or are you going to give it some equivalent? And are you going to recognize that the word dharma has many different meanings, and the sutra may intend more than one of those meanings at a time? There are some very deep subtleties to this matter. So, but I'll read the section. It's section 9. Let me see if Red Pine gave a title to it. I don't think he did. No, he didn't title his. This Chinese master titles it, The Four Fruits Are Empty. So in this particular section of the sutra, the Buddha is in a way comparing the Mahayana approach to enlightenment to the Hinayana approach, or Theravada, if you prefer, using a less pejorative term, because they don't like being called the Hinayana. But it's the earlier, the older path of the original Buddhism of the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Aryan Truths, and of the focus on codependent origination, and on the gradual approach to enlightenment, going through stages. And the main map offers four stages. So the Buddha is analyzing those stages and asking Subhuti basically what it's like to go through them. So without further ado, Subhuti, what do you say? Would it be right for a Shrotapanna, that's the first stage, a Shrotapanna to think like this, I have attained the fruit of a Shrotapanna? And he defines that term in the next sentence. Subhuti said, no, world-honored one. And why is this? Shrotapanna means the stream enterer, one who has entered the stream or the river. And yet, there is nothing to be entered. Indeed, to not enter into form or sound or smell or taste or touch or thought is what is called Shrotapanna. Okay? So, the first stage of reaching enlightenment is to enter the stream. But what stream are we talking about? Is it not the thought stream of a Buddha? And what is the thought stream of a Buddha? It's a stream of enlightened consciousness. But enlightened consciousness, of course, is non-dual. It has no beginning and no end. So once you enter that stream, is there any shore to go to on the other side? And when you realize there is no shore on the other side, you also realize there's no shore on your side. And you have always been in this stream because there's nothing else but this stream. And so what is the stream of consciousness that is the Buddha mind that one enters when one takes up the sadhana of this path? It is the realization that the world is an illusion, a dream. And one no longer enters into that dream. One doesn't believe in it. One loses all interest in it. And all of the thought stream of the ego that is not in non-duality, that is not Buddha mind, but is pure delusion, one will not enter into. So the first stage of the realization of the truth of the Buddha nature is already simply the Buddha nature. And so the first stage is already the last. But does anyone ever enter the first stage? Because already when you're in that stream, you realize you are never out of it, and you don't exist except as the Buddha nature. Not someone who goes, aha, there's the Buddha nature. I'm going to jump in that stream and get enlightened. It doesn't work that way. But the realization is that you have never been anything but that. And only this is truly entering the stream. So, that's the Shrotapanna. Now he goes on. Subhuti, what do you say? Would it be right for a Shakradagami, that's the second phase, to think like this? I have attained the fruit of a Shakradagami. Subhuti said, no, no, world-honored one. And why is this? The Shakradagami means the once returner. What it means is you have become so high in your consciousness that you've only got to come back one more lifetime. You know, you're that close. One lifetime away from Buddhahood. Not bad, right? That's the Hinayana approach. But of course, obviously, if you have any pride that you are one lifetime away, you've just put yourself 1,000 lifetimes away, because there's no ego in that state, right? So, Shakradagami means the one who is a once returner, and yet in truth, there's no such thing as returning. This is why it is called a Shakradagami. How can you return if you were never here in the first place? And what is there to return to if you can never leave it? And this has to be understood. It has to go so deeply into your bones that you get this, that there is no doubt of it, and there is no trace of an ego that doesn't get it. No fragments dissociated out there who still want to hold on to the belief that you're a separate individual being in a world, and you have a biological family, and you know, you're in a capitalist system, and you need to succeed and make money and prove yourself and get status and prestige, and you want to make sure you're not lonely, and you want to cling to somebody who'll take care of you, and blah, blah, blah. All of those delusions have nothing to do with the Buddha nature, which is pure non-duality and free of all conditions and free of time and space and every kind of fantasy or delusion of attaining anything whatsoever in the world, because there is nothing to attain and there is no world. It's all just a dream, and the dream is about to be over, and there will be the awakening into the real that is worldless. But that is already the truth. So if there's any ego about wanting to attain liberation or enlightenment or freedom, then you haven't reached the point where that is close. Okay. He goes on, Subhuti, what do you say? Would it be right for an anagami to... That's not monogamy, by the way. That's anagami, meaning one... to think that I have attained the fruit of an anagami. And Subhuti says, no, world-honored one, why is this? Anagami means a never-returner, one who will not come back. This is it. You're going to be liberated in this lifetime. And yet, in truth, there's no such thing as never returning, and this is the reason it is called anagami. So, even if you realize now the truth of all of this and recognize that there's no one to be reborn, there's no reincarnation because you're not incarnated, but if there's still an ego thought that I am someone who has attained this realization, you've lost it. No one can possess this. No one can own it. No one can say, I get it. The moment you say, I get it, and why don't those others get it, it means you've lost it entirely. Any kind of pride, any kind of superiority that you know something that others don't know, because of all the inner work you've done and all the sessions you've had and all the understanding you have of your past delusions and fears and all of that, none of that will matter, and all you'll do is create more karma if you take some credit for having achieved something, because that's the delusion. And that is what causes ego to fester and create envy and desire to be adored and recognized and validated and all of the detritus of the ego that follows upon the thought that I get it. Okay. Subhuti, what do you say? Would it be right for an arahat to think like this? I have attained the path, or I would say the truth of an arahat. No, world-honored one, and why? There is no dharma called arahat. World-honored one, if an arahat were to think, I have attained the path of an arahat, he would be clinging to self, to being a human, to sentient being, and to having a soul. So arahat is a word for, in the Hinayana lineage of one who has attained nirvana. And in that state, then, not only doesn't return to a life here, but won't go to lives in other dimensions, whether it's demonic planes or hell realms or divine heavenly realms. No, you've blown out the candle, and you're in nirvana. There's no trace of anyone to be reborn anywhere. But as soon as you have the thought, I've got to that point, of course, you're back in total delusion. So it seems that what is being gotten at by this section of the sutra is that even enlightenment is a fantasy. And of course, that's what Gaudapada also said. You know, all of Mahayana Buddhism is just an elaboration of the Ajatavada tradition or doctrine or realization that Ramana reached and taught. It's the same. The Ajatavada, the famous lines of Gaudapada, there is no bondage and no liberation. Here, there's no samsara and no nirvana. There's no enlightenment, there's no delusion, because delusion is unreal, and so is enlightenment, because no one achieves it. It's not a phenomenological state. It's not a shift in consciousness that belongs to someone. It is the end of the illusion of a someone somewhere achieving anything. World-honored one, the Buddha has said that I, this is Subhuti talking, have attained what is translated here as non-disputational samadhi. It's aranya is the word. It can mean the samadhi of dispassion or of no conflict. It's like the state of Ayodhya in the Ramayana. No conflict because it's a state of non-duality. There's no other and there's no self. So that state of no arguments, no fights, no disagreement. So he goes on, I am the best in this, and among all the arahats, I am also the best at going beyond desire. And yet, he says, I do not have the thought that I am an arahat who has gone beyond desire. Are you sure? You just said it. Are you sure you didn't have that thought? Man, we won't question that one. World-honored one, if I were to have the thought that I had attained the path of an arahat, then world-honored one would not have said that Subhuti takes delight in the practice of aranya. Since Subhuti is wholly without any practice of any kind, Subhuti has been said to take delight in the practice of aranya, or dispassion. So, the practice of Mahayana Buddhism is no practice, because there is no one to practice it. Therefore, it's effortless, because there is no one left making effort. If you think you're a someone who needs to make effort, or that you can't even make effort and it's hopeless, all of that is delusion, because there is only the Buddha nature, nothing other. And the fact, quote unquote, that in the dream field your character is in delusion and buys into duality and thinks you're a person with obligations in the world and desires and fears and wishes to improve your life and make things better in the world or whatever is the contents of the thought stream. It's irrelevant to the fact that your Buddha nature is already liberated from belief that you are that character. So the practice of Mahayana Buddhism is not intended to be understood by the person you think you are. That person cannot understand the logic of this. Even if momentarily you think you get it, it'll slip away. And the I thought will come back and you'll be a person in a world and you're saying, I wonder if it's going to rain tomorrow and I wonder if this and will I be better off here or there, or how should I invest my Bitcoin or whatever. But the mind is going to constantly go to the phenomenal plane desires of the ego consciousness and lose touch with the Buddha nature. And it doesn't matter one bit, because your character was never intended to grok the Buddha nature. However, once the Buddha nature is grokked, that character will no longer exist, because those delusional thoughts will stop arising. But they won't stop arising because I put an end to it through my willpower, but simply because there is no more energy breathing life into and being entertained by those thoughts. And so they gradually simply extinguish themselves and are replaced by the self-arising wisdom of the Buddha nature's insights and wisdom and power of luminous clarity. So you can understand that you're nobody, child of nobody, through the process of developing devotion for that which is the beloved who annihilates the illusion of the ego. Or you can realize that it's not even relevant whether that delusion gets annihilated, so long as you do not remain attached to it. Do not cling to the thoughts that arise from the character's ego mind. Recognize that they are simply mental objects arising by themselves. They're not your thoughts. They are the habitual thoughts of a program that's going on in the mind. And when you don't activate that program, and you don't want more from it, it will shut down, and eventually it will delete itself from the thought stream. But it will be irrelevant whether that happens, because the focus and the locus of your attention will be in the blissful light of the Buddha nature, the Atman, the Paramashiva, center of consciousness, and will no longer be disturbed by whatever the character does within the dream, or whatever any character does in the dream. And this is available at every moment. Okay, I think that's all that I intended to say about this section, but if it has raised any questions, the floor is open, and we can discuss anything that you wish, and not just in this section. So any questions that you have about your spiritual journey, especially if you're going to be leaving the ashram soon, please feel free to ask. Keep it at zero.
Also, a special thanks to Hamrita, which I learn to know with times, with communications, and I learned a lot about professionalism. Is Riger, she's Riger, but sweet, sweet, the nectar of bliss in action.
Indeed.
And Rita is a name very important for me because I was not taking care, but I was associated with a church in Montreal for 15 years, and it was St. Rita's. And in the Catholic narrative, St. Rita is the patron of the desperate causes, which fit with me a little bit. Another special thanks to Saraswati. I've learned lots of stuff, but I will just name one. I've learned at least the methodology. So when I'm going to a course now, I take notes, so I'm more part of the course instead of being like a sponge and just listening. So I guess I get more things like that. So thank you very much, because the first retreat, I had no question that came to my mind, and it was like embarrassing. So now, since I'm taking notes every time I went to courses, so I was more there. So thank you very much. I came here with the idea, with a funny idea, to get killed, right? And one of the first line you've said in the first retreat was, well, if you come to an ashram, it's to die. So I was like, okay, I'm the right place, I'm the right fit. Still, I feel the guy inside is still alive and kicking. And but to another teaching that you've gave earlier, you also said that before killing the ego, you must refine and purify it. Well, my question would be, like, there's also the concept of the one shot, the one bow. You kill it on one shot. Mm-hmm. But there's also the concept where you cannot do it without refining the ego first, or purification, thing like that. And just to end all this, I would say what I've learned here, throughout my life, like everybody else, I've got knockouts and hard knocks, which are not very important, as long as you go back on your feet fast. But a collapse, it's more, a collapse is a collapse. It takes too much time to get back on your feet. You just lost the battle. You just can't live to fight another day. And from the teaching of the Satyoga school, I may have learned things like, all right, the Kundalini map and the chakras, not to get engulfed into any chakra, especially the lower chakras. Just staying on the top, which I forget the name, the assemblage point. So, to me, a collapse now is you just get engulfed into a lower chakra. This is why you stay down too long for a too long period of time.
The direct path is to recognize that there is no ego. The ego is a dead program of habitual thoughts. Mm-hmm. But once you recognize that they're not your thoughts, they lose their power to create an emotional reaction, and they lose their power to bring about behavior based on those delusional ideas. And so the consciousness will have a margin of freedom from both desire and fear, and from any of the thoughts that arise from this program. And once you are clear that you are not the program, the ego will not disturb you anymore, because it's not real, and there's no one to fight it. Because any desire to fight it or to avoid collapse or any of that, those are the thoughts of the ego itself. And the ego is already in a collapsed state because it can't be in any other state. It's a delusional thought form. So the main thing is not to identify with desires. Do not identify with any concepts, and do not identify with any belief that you are a person in a world of multiplicity, because it's a dream field that is one single consciousness and not many, and there is no self, no other. There is just the intelligence of the one self. And anything else is just a delusional arising in the mind. And when you are not captured by it, it has no effect on you. And the fullness of the power of presence of the real self will take over and overwhelm any traces of ego residue. And the full glory of God consciousness or the Buddha nature will fill the consciousness, and there will be no doubts, no question, and no return to the delusional thought forms. So that's the main thing, is recognize that this has nothing to do with the character that you think you are, or with the body, or where it's located in space or time. It's purely the consciousness that is timeless. That's all that's real.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So how many of you are already free of desire, concepts, and belief that you're a someone in a world? How many of you have freed yourself of those three delusions? Ah. Well, since no one exists anyway, we're all free already.
Well, I just wanted to thank all you NPCs, non-existent characters, for playing such amazing roles and for having touched my heart so beautifully. So, and I'll be back. Namaste.
Namaste. Is everyone shy or free of questions? You totally get it? Does everyone get it? How many feel you understood what the Diamond Sutra was saying? Anyone? Ah. It's good that you don't get it, because it's inconceivable, this truth. So if you did think you got it, then that would prove you didn't. So you're very wise.
Hello. So I want to get a bit more clarity on what seems to be a paradox. You were mentioning, and you've said this before, it doesn't matter what the character's doing. And that kind of, I feel like I'm on a path as Michelle was saying, like a purification path, and the idea that it doesn't matter because that's not what we are. Mm-hmm. I find that hard to, like the idea that, okay, it doesn't matter if no one's changing, myself or the other, because that's not really who they are. Mm-hmm. But then that means that nothing changes at this level. But then you also went on to say that if you lose interest in the character, then it dissolves. So that seems like a paradox. Is it that it will dissolve and it will no longer exist, or it can still exist and it doesn't matter because you're a Buddha anyway?
Well, does it exist? You see, you think it exists, but the moment you realize you're not it, you'll realize it never existed at all. That was only a delusion of the delusional character. There really isn't one, and there really isn't a world in which it could exist. But you'll only know that when you realize you're not the character, and you don't care if the character changes at all. That's the point. You must have no desire for purification. Mm-hmm. That's what purification is. In the same way that the bodhisattva's vow is to save all beings, mm-hmm. but the only way he can do it is if he realizes that there is no one to save. Correct? Mm-hmm. Right? It's mm-hmm. the same logic. Okay? Mm-hmm. You are the Buddha nature now. You are the Atman. You are the Self. You can't be any more pure than you are. It doesn't matter at all the state of your character. It could be psychotic. It could be criminal. It could be anything. Totally irrelevant. You know, one of the greatest saints of Buddhism, I was telling someone this week, is Milarepa, who was a mass murderer, you know, and then he converted and he became this very, you know, incredibly wonderful being who is beloved of all. But, you know, the crimes he committed, it didn't matter. Once there was that realization, non-duality releases the consciousness from karma, which is also a mm-hmm. delusion. So the paradox is that once you have really, and it has to be authentic, recognized that you are not the character, and therefore what you are is pure awareness that does not think. It does not cling to concepts, and there's nothing it wants because it's complete in itself. And it recognizes that all is its own dream, meaning that everyone in the world is the projection of your consciousness, mm-hmm. not some other, and therefore there's no conflict. Mm-hmm. You're in non-disputational samadhi, mm-hmm. then, right? So that is the purification, just that realization. The character can be as awful and as stupid and ignorant and uninterested in growth and purification as it wants to be. It will no longer have any effect on you because it was just a fabrication that was created in response to an environment in which that body form grew up and its mind stream had to collapse the wave functions to satisfy the demands of a family system and a social system. Mm-hmm. But your consciousness was never trapped in that. Mm-hmm. There was never any bondage and therefore no need for liberation. Mm-hmm. So once it's recognized that you were never that character, then it's just a dream in God's mind. Let God take care of, you know, purifying the character. But God, of course, is nothing other than that same realization that there is nothing but pure awareness, luminous clarity, which is blissful and complete and without desire or fear or attachment or illusion of any kind. Mm-hmm. And that is your state right now, regardless of the thought stream of the character.
Okay.
I hope that helps.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
The question's about devotion.
Uh-huh.
In Buddhism, is that not really their path? When you were talking earlier about the difference between the two paths in a way of devotion and jnana, in Buddhism, they reach there's nothing to reach, but there's just a blissful, there's nirvana. But is that, are they not a devotion? Is it not a devotional?
No, pattern? In fact, they're anti-devotion. Mm-hmm. They say if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. Mm-hmm. Don't bow to him. Don't prostrate. Right? Mm-hmm. So, no. There's no there's no devotion, but the state of one's consciousness as the Buddha nature or as the self is infinite love. Mm-hmm. And generosity and compassion and joy and total delight. So that's the natural state. There's no duality, so therefore no devotion, but there's a recognition that everyone in the dream field is also a manifestation of Buddha. Mm-hmm. And so, of the one self. So that recognition means that you are constantly God meeting God, and so there is more than devotion. There is an honoring and a natural reverence and adoration and astonishment, fascination, and total joy in every experience and every event. Mm-hmm. And one will be able to perceive its hidden innermost meaning and implication that wouldn't be noticed by the superficial ego mind, but that the Buddha mind understands and perceives the truth, even if it's screened by ego defenses. And that recognition brings total delight in every situation.
Okay. Thank you. That was beautiful. Very helpful.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Namaste. Going on to the realization of knowing that you're not the character. Like, there's this, I feel like there's this bridge that needs to be jumped through or hopped through or realized. What is that switch that makes one realize it? The love for God, or how does a realization manifest?
It's your natural state, okay? It's just a matter of noticing that in between your thoughts, what are you? And when you ask the question, who am I or what am I, do you get an answer? You don't. I don't think you do, right? There's nothing there. Emptiness. That's the answer. You don't exist. There's emptiness. And the thought patterns that go on, they're just habit. They're reflex. If you're honest with yourself, you'll realize you're not thinking. The thoughts are popping up by themselves. What you think of as your thoughts have nothing to do with you. They're just popping up. And because you identify with it, because the thought says, I'm hungry, you say, oh, and then you go to the refrigerator and get some. You're not hungry. The thought said it was hungry. But you bought into it because you believed it was your thought. It's not. It's just a thought arising in the mind stream. And many thoughts that arise actually come from the media or somebody else who has that thought and is transmitting it into the morphic field, you know. So suddenly everybody is hungry at the same time and they line up to eat, you know. It has nothing to do with real hunger, you know. And it has nothing to do with anybody actually feeling anything at all, except, oh, the thought arose, it's time to go, you know. And so everyone who's identified behaves like a lemming. Oh, today we're all getting vaccinated. Okay, you know, today we're all jumping over the cliff. Okay, you know, if you identify with these thoughts, you'll do incredibly stupid things. But as soon as you realize, well, these aren't my thoughts. These are the thoughts of the field that are being picked up. And the thoughts I got from other people long ago and words of songs I heard being played and, you know, stupid dialogues of TV programs I watched or videos or something, you know, they all get mixed in with the mind stream. None of them are yours. And once you realize all you are is that which is aware of them and that has the choice not to buy into them and say, you know, I'm not really hungry and I don't really want to do this or that. That thought is it was a stupid thought. I don't care that it came up. It's not, I don't buy it. And as soon as you realize that all of the thoughts are in that category, then you turn to the deeper level of your being, which has real wisdom and power and the ability to discern what is real from what is unreal. And then it happens by itself. The liberation is attained, but not by anyone, right? It's just the silencing of the mind or the not identifying with the mind even when it's not silent. It's irrelevant if the mind is silent, as long as you don't identify with its chatter. And by not identifying with its chatter, it becomes silent by itself.
Okay? Thank you, but I still don't quite get how do you
realize
that.
See, that's not your thought. Uh-huh. That's the ego trying to create a problem. Don't identify with that thought.
But
and
how
then,
do you not
then you'll realize you have no. You are already totally self-realized. You are absolutely liberated at this very moment. Just don't believe the thoughts that say you're not. If you'll do that for one day, they'll stop appearing and you'll realize they were never true. They were just thoughts of a delusional, non-real character that believes she doesn't get it and she's not worthy and she's not able to. It's premises that are built into the program of the ego. To feel like this is you're not able to understand it. It's not true. And the moment you realize that that character was created by other people's projections on you, poof, you'll delete it out of your mind stream, and your total wisdom and power and luminous understanding will fully emerge.
Thank you, Shunya. I have two questions. The first is in regards to the sutras that you've been reading. And it's the Buddha is saying that they are the appearance of non-appearance. I guess it arises a question in me, what is the Tathagata? What is, when we say Ramana is not the picture, he wasn't the man, but it's the consciousness, right? But it's appearing.
Consciousness is appearing? No.
Okay, so what is appearing? What is that? What is a sage? What's happening?
Well, first of all, do you recognize that this is a dream?
I'm trying. Usually when I wake up first thing in the morning.
Okay. So, as long as you know that this is a dream, and not different from the dreams you had when the body was asleep, then you must know that there has to be a consciousness that's outside the dream that's dreaming it, right? That's what a sage is that consciousness. And because it's not in the dream, it's not connected or identified with any body, okay? But it will come through a particular body that had the karma of going through those kinds of events that created a rupture in the ego and the downloading or of the channeling of that wisdom of the Buddha nature or the self that then has a clear channel and takes over the use of that organism. In other words, the dreamer becomes lucid in the dream and uses that character as a way to express that lucidity to all of the nodes of consciousness within the dream field. But it's not a person in a dream who is talking. It's the dreamer speaking to the consciousnesses who are fragments of the dreamer that are the dreamer's projections that through that knowledge get to return to that state of total awakening.
Haji, thank you. My other question was in regards to these, to the different paths, the bhakti path, the jnana path. And I think, and am I accurate in saying that this is a school that uses all paths, the kundalini path and the, in order to, because I feel like the ego is such a stubborn lemming that as soon as I latch onto something, that's the end of it, right? That, and so I need to meditate, and then that doesn't work, so I need to have a jnana class, and then that doesn't work, so I need to back to worship and to adore. And
yes, but again, you're identifying with the ego's thoughts that this doesn't work and that doesn't work. The truth is, it doesn't matter if it works or not for that character because you're not that character. Let the character be as ridiculous as possible. It's totally irrelevant. You're already the Buddha. And let the character jump and play and do its monkey business. It doesn't. It's totally irrelevant. You see, that's the point. Don't care about the character, and then it immediately becomes the instrument of the real self.
Haji, thank you.
The ego likes to make it as hard as possible. This is a very simple realization.
Thank you for this class, Shunya. I have a question about the simplicity of it and the effortlessness. Because I believe you mentioned earlier that it's not really a practice that's done. However, I do feel that not identifying with the thoughts, it takes a type of effort and a type of constant awakeness an effort to keep the mind constantly awake, to not fall into the traps of the thoughts. And the desire in the ego and the fear as well, I feel that for the ego, there's for the character, there's a comfort into falling into those states.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because there's a kind of familiarity with it or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I've noticed that even when fear arises, for example, there's something in a strange way that's comforting about it, even though it's totally uncomfortable. And it leads one to make decisions that are not the best decisions, and etc. But so it's a question of does it take effort? It seems like it does.
It only seems like it takes effort when the resistance to the truth of your being is extremely great, and you have to overcome its attachment to a collapsed state or to fulfilling its habitual patterns of behavior and creating the usual kind of effects on the field that that character has as its signature, right? Mm-hmm. And so it wants to be able to appear in all of its idiosyncrasies. Right, and so if that character changes suddenly, well, you're not the same person, and so there's this homeostatic desire not to change. So you can either wait until the character gets so frustrated and disgusted with itself that it no longer wants to resist that, and then begins to have actual devotion and God, please save me, get me out of this. It can do it that way. Or you can realize you are not that character, you are not the thoughts, you are not actually the one who just spoke what your character spoke, but you are the awareness that is watching it all and even amazed that you just said that and you believe that because you know it's all nonsense and you just want your character to display itself again and continue those behavioral patterns as if they equal who you are, when of course they don't. And who you are never appears in the world. It's simply the pure intelligence of total presence.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand. But
your character doesn't understand. But don't identify with that I.
Mm.
Okay? Because the understanding is there, or you wouldn't be here. You're here because you understand that this is the truth.
Mm.
But there's still a character that wants to play its games. However, it doesn't matter that the character wants to play its games. As long as you know you're not the character, let it play. But stay in the truth of what you are as pure presence and luminous clarity that you're not the character. And gradually you will see that it begins to shrink. Its thoughts do not interfere. Its emotions don't create crises for you. And all of the melodramas of the ego will begin to become very peaceful and serene, and to the ego, very boring.
Mm.
But at some point, it will no longer have the power to create agitation and interference and cause other people to worry about you and other kinds of situations to arise in the wake of all the emotional upheavals that are going on. All of that you will have lost all interest in, and you'll be interested in the total oceanic consciousness of infinite intelligence, and all of that will drop away forever.
Mm. Haji? Okay. It may be so. Thank you.
Okay. Any last question anyone wishes to ask, or anything you want to share? Okay.
Thank you. I've been wanting to share all night, but I'm not sure what I wanted to share. It's been an extremely frustrating class, which I feel like you're going to say, that's great. And what I've realized during the class is that I'm trying to get this with a rational mind, and you just can't get this with these rational thoughts.
No, it's definitely rational what I'm saying,
okay.
But it's a different logic than the binary logic of the ego.
Okay.
It's a different kind of logic. It's an infinite logic, whereas the logic of the ego is a binary. Everything is true or false.
Right, okay.
But reality isn't really like that, right? So, but because of that, The ego cannot hold these thoughts that are more subtle and not in that binary category.
So that's the thought process that's been going through my mind.
Yeah,
the ego's mind. Like, what do you mean you're not in the river? What do you mean there's no river? You already are liberated. But you know, it's like everything is like the opposite of what it is.
Not of what it is, of what you think.
What you think it is.
That's right.
You know, it's just, it's everything is so paradoxical, and the ego doesn't
right.
do that.
Because the ego is delusional. As soon as you stop the ego thoughts for long enough, you'll get this very clearly. It's very simple. But the ego chops it up because it believes that there's objects and subjects, mm-hmm. and there's right and wrong and good and bad and yes and no, and it chops everything up into these dualities, so it never has a holistic view of the real as it is. And it's that mind that cannot connect all the dots, because it has to keep, it's this or that, it can't be both, right? Mm-hmm. And it can't be both and neither and beyond. So there's a logic that needs to be much more inclusive and based on the whole, not on the part.
Yeah, there's just so much, I'm realizing there's so much resistance to that holistic,
sure.
holisticness, you know, and
it's the end of the reality of egocentricity.
Mm-hmm.
That paradigm can't be justified anymore. And one recognizes that you are the whole, not the individual that you thought you were. And so there has to be a letting go of identification with that character. And that's what hurts. It creates grief, you know. because you're losing, you know, an icon that was your friend, and this, I knew who I was. Now I'd have no idea who I am, and entering into that great unknownness is terrifying to the ego. So it doesn't want to get it; it prefers to be frustrated.
Right, and it's crazy because it just opens up a whole new world of just so much more, but that's so frightening, And the other thing I was pondering was one of the only things that kind of gave some relief and some peace tonight was when you said you're not that character, and it reminded me of what I've shared in the Ramayana of when Rama says, "Parvati, is that you? You know, like you can't believe that you're that character. You know, when he steps out of that, still plays the role, but he doesn't believe he is that role.
That's right.
And that's what you're saying. And I feel like it's like this ticket out of jail. You know, go past jail, free card, whatever that Monopoly card is. You know."
Okay, so you've get shifted from free, frustration to relief.
Yeah.
And just like that. It's beautiful.
But I feel like in the moments where when one is in crisis or things are, there are struggle, you want to get out of that. But when things seem good, why would you want to believe that you're not that character? You like that character. So that's where I find like it's...
Sure, but remember, it's always a conflict of good versus good. And you might have a slice of cake that's good, but somebody else has got a whole cake they're offering you that might be even more good. And why do you want the slice when you can have the whole thing, right? So be more greedy than you are. You know? You're satisfied with too few of the crumbs of the table of God's banquet.
Thank you.
All right. So I hope everyone wants to eat not at the kids' table or under the table, but you know, you want to be at the adults' table so you get the wine and you get all of the delights that only come from sitting at the table of realizing you don't exist. That's the way you drink the elixir of bliss and you get the nectar of immortality. And you realize the eternal life of the spirit that you are that enables you to live with nobility and royalty and without complaint and without anger and without fear and without clinging and without groveling and without being dominated by anything. But you are able to have that power of freedom that enables you to change the dream field because of the authenticity of your presence speaking and living truth. The power of truth is overwhelming if you will claim that truth from the deepest place within your being. But that truth is not the truth of the ego, which is an untruth that's based on its desire to have it its own way. This is the truth of the whole. And when that truth is recognized, then the whole will be in agreement with you because you are expressing the truth of all beings. And all beings are Buddha beings. And in that level of consciousness, then the dream morphs into a heavenly realm or a realm of total radiant, intelligent light that is the expression of and emanation of that supreme intelligence that is formless and boundless and infinite. But that's what you are at this very moment. So let go of the identification of a little slice of matter in a world in which the illusion of matter and energy have occluded the truth that everything is pure consciousness, and return to that, and then you can transform the dream effortlessly. So don't miss out on the inheritance of consciousness that is available to one who has dropped the ego and realized the Buddha nature. This is the great exchange. If you're willing to trade your ego and get your infinite self in exchange, don't hold on to the ego. You have made a bad decision. The infinite self is priceless, and the ego, frankly, is worthless. So choose what has true value and abide as that. Blessings to all. Namaste.